Blog Talk Radio.
So we are back here after a quick break, and do we have Kevin on the line here with us, Mike?
Okay. Hello, testing.
Hello, testing. Hello, hello.
Yeah, you can hear me, Mike.
I can hear you, Smith. And Mike,
I can hear
you. That's the question. Yeah, I don't think Mike can hear us.
So. It should be something that he can pick.
I got you. I got you.
You can
What's
hear
it, Mike? Yeah, I can hear you, Mike.
Are we on the air now, Mike?
Yes.
All right, another technical glitch here, but all fair and all in love and war. Do we have Kevin on the line with us here now?
Yes, we do. I'm gonna patch him in. You guys want to announce him? I'll patch him in.
All right.
Okay.
Sounds good. So we'll start again here with this. So we're gonna introduce. He was a former WWE writer from 2011 to 2014. He was a great. He's part of a very transformative few years with the WWE. He's a very special guest. We're gonna get right to it. Mr. Kevin Eck. Is Kevin with us right now? Kevin,
I guess not.
I'm here.
Oh,
hey, Kevin.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Nice to hear your voice.
Likewise.
Thank you.
So, Kevin, we just wanted to, get into it right away and ask a few questions here. I understand you were actually writing for the Baltimore Sun when you first got signed with WWE, is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. I actually spent a long time at the Baltimore Sun. I got into the journalism business actually when I was a senior in high school. I actually started as an unpaid intern and kind of worked my way up. So I was working at the paper all through college and such. And, I was, by the time I left for WWE, I had been at the Sun through two different stints for about 20 years altogether. So, yeah, I've been there a long, long time before I left.
And how did the transformation of coming to work for the WWE creative team actually come to fruition at that stage?
Well, I mean, I'll try to not make it too long of a story, but I've been a fan of the wrestling business my entire life, basically since I was 6 years old. And I took that interest with me as I pursued a career in journalism. And wanted to write about it any chance I could get. Now, I worked in the sports department at the Baltimore Sun, and we had a pretty strict rule that they didn't really want to cover pro wrestling unless there could be an actual.
No, we call it grunt and groan and wrestling.
Exactly. Unless they could make a sports connection to it. Like my first article that I ever wrote was in 1994, and it was about the Macho Man Randy Savage, who was making a personal appearance in Baltimore that year to promote the King of the Ring, which took place in Baltimore. And I was able to get a story in the paper because I pitched it to my editor that, Randy Savage used to be a minor league baseball player. So we took it from that aspect of former minor league baseball player turned pro wrestler so I could get it in the paper. So I had been writing about wrestling any chance I could get in the Sun, and eventually developed a pro wrestling blog that I started there in, I think it was 2007. So really kind of my involvement kind of took off from there. I'm going to go back a little bit, rewind. The first time I left the Sun was in 2000, and that was to work as the editor of WCW Magazine. So I had worked in the business for a year until Vince bought WCW and put us all out of business. But I had already had a year in the business from 2000 to 2001. In 2011, I had gotten to know Kevin Dunn. I had been introduced to him, and I had found out that Kevin, who I'm sure everyone knows, executive producer in WWE, Kevin is a Baltimore guy like me and apparently became a fan of my blog, the Baltimore Sun Wrestling blog. And I was introduced to him once, and he asked me if I had ever thought about coming to work for them on the creative side. And I said that I absolutely had, and it kind of went from there. He set up an interview for me, and that's how I ended up working for WWE.
Well, I envy you.
The creative aspect is probably a lot more different today than it was, obviously, when Smith was, you know, booking for Stampede Wrestling and during the territory era. What was like a day-to-day booking situation for like you? Like, how did you fit in with the booking? Or the creative aspect of WWE while you were there?
Well, I mean, the creative team was divided up into two teams, which was we had a home and a road. The home team is worked out of the office in Stamford 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. And the road team traveled to the shows. Monday, Raw, Tuesday, SmackDown, they'd fly back on Wednesday. And then they'd actually come into the office on Thursday. And we'd work with the whole team would work together usually just on Thursday. I was part of the home team, so I was based in Stamford, but I did some traveling. I went to some of the shows. Usually, maybe once a month, I would make the loop, starting with the pay per view, and then I'd do the Raw and SmackDown for the next two nights. But basically, you know, on Mondays we would sit in on the production meeting via satellite. So even though we were on the home team, there would be a camera hooked up to whatever arena Raw was coming from, and the home team was part of that production meeting. Same thing on Tuesday for SmackDown. The rest of our week, we really spent working on booking the shows, Raw and SmackDown, and also we would divide up into groups many times and work on long-term storylines. We would take, if we knew a program was coming up, say it was, you know, just as an example, John Cena and Seth Rollins, going to be in a program together, we would sit down and try and map it out from pay-per-view to pay-per-view and try and fill in some of the major beats along the way for the TV shows. Every Thursday, we would select few of the writers, of which I was fortunate enough to be one. There was about five of us. Every Thursday, we would meet in Vince's office, and basically what we would do is pitch him our big ideas for Raw. A lot of times we intended to get to SmackDown. I don't know if we ever did. I think it was always we would just get the big ideas for Raw, get Vince's okay, and then write the scripts from there. We'd also talk about...
Kevin, did your input include matchmaking as well? Who's going to fight who? Or was it they gave you that and then you had to figure out the scenario for X versus Y?
Yeah, we were able to pitch programs as well. You know, we would especially, you know, just to use John Cena as an example. John being the top guy, Vince was always very, you know, rightfully so. He always wanted to know what's John doing and not just what is he doing this week or this month, but what's he doing 2-3 months down the line. So we would then suggest, you know, possible programs. And yeah, so in a sense, we were doing the matchmaking. As far as the weekly shows, we definitely pitched the matches to Vince that we thought should be on Raw and SmackDown. So in a sense, we were not only coming up with storylines, but also, you know, telling the stories through the matches. So we did pitch matches as well.
I suppose you'd come up with ideas, too, like if you say going to Disneyland or going to some army town or something, they might figure in some benefit from that when the time came.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And were you working also in doing, like, character development, match finishes? Like, is it all totally comprehensive, or is there specific people in the office that are working on specific aspects of the product?
Well, we worked on all of it, you know, character development, the whole thing. We would we had a good number of writers at one point.
Who was working with you at the time? Who are your peers?
I mean, obviously Michael Hayes was working closely with us. Brian Gewirtz, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that name or not, but Brian was he was with WWE for a long stretch, starting in the late 90s. Brian was running the home team when I got there. Ed Koski is another guy that had been there for a while. He became the Raw head writer. Dave Kapoor also was a head writer who played the character of Ranjan Singh. And near the end of my stint there, we brought Road Dogg, Brian James, into the room with us. He was also part of the creative team. And there were a lot of other, you know, we had a lot of writers that names you wouldn't necessarily recognize, people that came from, Hollywood or soap operas or had other professional writing experience who would join the team. But what we would do with characters a lot of times is we would assign certain wrestlers on the roster to different writers, and it was kind of your assignment to come up with things for them, help them develop characters, you know, pitch them for storylines. So it was really, a group effort. Like I said, with so many writers, we all were able to not only pitch the week-to-week stuff, but also look at long-term, try to look at guys on the roster or girls who weren't doing a whole lot, try to help them develop their character, help them come up, you know, with the storylines. So it really was pretty comprehensive. As far as match finishes, that was really we could make suggestions on things, but that was pretty much left to, Vince would be the sign-off on the finishes. And it was really up to the producers, the agents, to obviously, you know, to work on the finishes and stuff like that. We didn't get involved in that too much.
Well, yeah, you brought up a point there, and I kind of wanted to touch on this a little bit. You know, obviously Vince McMahon is the be-all, say-all, and has the final say on everything. And obviously, I don't want to put you in a rough spot to say anything, but you know, we both Smith and myself have been in the WWE locker room. Smith has family there, TJ and Natty, and then sure. Of course Harry was there during your run as well. Now, while you were there in 2011 to 2014, we've seen Harry specifically get really shifted right down to the bottom of the roster. Here's a guy that's 6'6", you know, got third-generation superstar, one of the best lineages in all of professional wrestling, and he is one hell of an actual wrestler, somebody that you would think by today's NXT standard would be one of their top guys. And
sure.
He was put right down at the very bottom of the card. Can you let us understand, like, maybe what was going on in the creative room when it came to maybe booking Harry during that time?
Yeah, who fucked him?
I could be, you know, I'm trying to remember back, but I think by the time I got there, Harry was already gone. TJ
yeah.
and Natty obviously were definitely there, but I don't believe Harry was there when I started. If he was, he wasn't there for very long. So I really can't speak too much to that.
I remember Harry's, I think, final match on television where he fought JBL and... He didn't even defend himself. He didn't even throw a punch. He was like a doormat or a rag doll. Like in other words, Bradshaw beat nobody. He beat a, you might as well have been fighting a mannequin or a wig or something. There was just nothing there. Harry didn't even he just got knocked about. Like he wasn't the same guy that he was on all the other previous shows. And
right.
To me, I didn't see the point of that. There was no logic in it. And I don't know, but if you weren't there, it's not feasible to pin you on any of that.
There are other wrestlers, obviously, that kind of went up and down the cards during that time. Specifically, another one was Zack Ryder. Hugely, immensely popular with the internet show, and then you seemed like he was going to get a good break with the company getting behind him, and then it just got cut off right at that time. That was when you were there as well, wasn't it?
That was definitely – I was definitely there for that. Tell you, just in being there, that Vince and Hunter as well never really got Zack Ryder. They never really understood why he was starting to get over. I don't think – I don't want to put words in their mouths either, but I got the impression that it just kind of befuddled them. that people were actually getting behind this guy. But, you know, Vince is, you know, say what you want about him, but I think at the time he was like, okay, well, let's listen to the audience. It sounds like they're getting behind this guy, so let's do it. Let's get behind
makes
it.
Makes sense.
And I remember when Zach won the U.S. title from Dolph Ziggler. It actually took place in Baltimore. And, man, it was a huge pop when he won the title. And remember the next night on Raw, we had CM Punk, Daniel Bryan, and Zack Ryder started the show with a promo because they were the world champion, WWE champion, and U.S. champion. And it was all three guys.
A lot of independent guys in that.
Exactly. Three guys who were not your stereotypical WWE guy. Now, of course, Punk and Bryan continued to ascend and be huge stars, whereas Ryder obviously didn't. And I think what hurt Ryder was in real life, he's kind of a little – look, I love the guy personally. I think he's a great guy. But I think Hunter and Vince kind of looked at him as he's a little bit goofy. He's kind of a goofy guy. And you know, that doesn't translate into, I think, what Vince sees as a WWE superstar. And I know what really hurt him a lot was when he was put into an angle with Kane where he was sort of John Cena's best friend. And that was his biggest opportunity. He got a chance to be in a lot of backstage vignettes with Kane and Cena, and Eve Torres was involved at that point. And I don't think Zach really hit a home run when it came to his acting ability, his facial expressions. We get the ratings for all the segments, and I think one or two of Zach's segments might have tanked in the ratings. So at that point, I think it gave Vince and Hunter the ammunition to say, well, see, you know, we were right about this guy all along. And that was pretty much the end of Zack Ryder's push, unfortunately.
Yeah. Were you part of writing some of the those angles there?
I mean, I was a contributor to it, and you know, I have to say, as much as I was behind Zack Ryder, and I heard the crowd was obviously behind him, I think we did put him in maybe a little bit over his head with some of the things we were asking him to do. I don't know if you'll recall the storyline, but you know, Kane was pushing him off the stage pretty much every week, and Zach was in a wheelchair and being pushed around, and he wasn't put in a great – they weren't great scenarios to be involved in. And it was almost ridiculous. You know, he was in a wheelchair and constantly being thrown off the stage and things like that. But I don't think he did himself any favors when he was asked to recite some dialogue. And like I said, I think that was ultimately what did him in, and Vince looked at some of the ratings and – you know, pretty much that was it. You know, we were trying to have a little romance developing in the story with him and Eve. And I think Vince just looked at Eve and then looked at Zach and said, my God, why would she ever look at him? And we're like,
God,
well,
that's heterosexual.
We're like, well, because we want to write it that way that she's attracted to him. But apparently Vince didn't see it that way.
Yeah. There was a couple other guys that, you know, come up during that period of time that you were there that seemed, you know, all the making top superstars in the company. And they would get into a position, a couple of names I'm going to name, Brodus Clay, Ryback, and Lord Tenzai. It seemed they were brought in to be headliners and main eventers. They had all the makings. You could see Brodus Clay being the guy that could have, you know, been the younger version of a Big Show or Kane, you know, a big monster. And then, you know, Tenzai coming in from Japan, he was a huge star in New Japan, coming back, you know, that seemed great. Ryback had all the makings of a Goldberg, kind of Ultimate Warrior style character, but inevitably with all of them, they all got their legs cut out when the big win was meant to happen. And, you know, did you see this transition coming, or like what happened with like the characters that we just mentioned?
Well, I mean, each one was kind of a different case. With Brodus, I think, you know, a lot of us looked at him and thought, all right, this guy's going to be a monster, a big monster heel. He had the look. He had the size. But I think Vince, a lot of times, you know, loves to look outside the box and said, okay, well, that's the obvious thing that we can do with him. You know, can this guy sing and dance? And he actually posed that question. Can he sing? Can he dance? And he was serious. And he thought, you know, we could go a totally different direction with this guy. Instead of doing what everyone expects, making him the monster heel and having him run through the roster and all that, let's go the other way and make him a dancing babyface. And that's what he saw when he looked at Brodus. Now, Brodus got a nice push in the beginning, but, you know, the sense that I got from Vince was that, which he said on several occasions, was he didn't think Brodus fully embraced the character. And I think there was sort of a feeling with the agents and such that Brodus, you know, his heart wasn't into it. Maybe he didn't work quite as hard at his craft as some other people. And, you know, and I think that's what happened with Brodus Clay. Was I think Vince just fell in love with that character and immediately fell out of love with it. And not immediately, but
being
a while,
dancing
right?
Eunuch is not much of an inspiration, though. I believe you that his heart wasn't in it. It didn't seem to be at all in it.
You know, right, and I think you know,
he'd been
Brodus
a rap singer or something. He was connected to Snoop Dogg, and they didn't really play up on that I recall.
That's correct. He was Snoop's bodyguard at one point. But
he's more, you know, to make him a gangster rapper or something, but just a sort of a big dancing bear or something, a big freak. To me, I wouldn't be too inspired either.
Yeah, and I really blame him. But I think Vince looks at it as, hey, I'm presenting you with a huge opportunity here, and the machine's getting behind you.
You
know, we've got a big entrance for you.
Who would he have fought? You know, like as a baby face, as a big buffoon baby face, who would he have fought? He needs some big monsters to fight, and I don't know how many were bigger than him outside of the Big Show.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So that was the story of Brodus. Ryback was a guy who really was kind of thrown into things. Circumstances happened with injuries and things, and he had to be thrust into the main event spotlight really before he was fully ready for it. And I think, in retrospect, that's what hurt him, is it was kind of too much too soon, and there was almost nowhere to go for him from there. Ryback's had his ups and downs. Every time every time you think WWE's behind him, he sort of, as you said, kind of gets his knees cut off from underneath him. I don't know. Again, I've been out of the company for a year and a half now, so I can't speak to anything that's happened after the summer of, just as a fan watching it, I get frustrated.
Feed me more. Whose brainchild was that?
I'm pretty sure Ryback came up with that one on his own.
Ryback
was,
well,
Ryback
I hope
had
sold a lot
of t-shirts.
Input. I didn't like it. You know, to me, they could have come up with something a lot more dynamic and, you know, but, I think they don't take time. They just want to get it. They want to shove it down the fans' throats and get those shirts selling no matter what the hell. You know, just get something on a shirt and sell it Cena style.
And just being around
old
Ryback.
School, like where you know.
I could tell you, being around Ryback, he was very much into that mentality himself. Because, as I said, I think he came up with Feed Me More. And he was constantly thinking of, it's funny that you mentioned t-shirts and stuff. He was thinking of that, like what would look good on a t-shirt. You know, he came up with the big guy on his own. That's another thing he came up with. Vince hated it. When Ryback Ryback did that all on his own, he started referring to himself as the big guy in his promos. And Vince was like, who came up with that? You know, he was yelling at us. And we're like, well, he did. Ryback did. That's awful. Big guy, I don't get it.
To me, what makes a heel or a baby face is just who you throw them against. You know, a good-looking, smaller, you know, most baby faces are, you know, clean-cut, normal-sized guys, you know, compared to the, and the heel has the advantage of size, if not other things, besides maybe a manager and more experience and other things that would get him hated, like he's foreign or he's this or he's that. But, so if Ryback had just been a big monster eating up babyface, you know, scrub jobbers after jobbers, like they don't even have jobbers anymore. Everybody is a superstar and has to win by some means. But, you know, it's one of the fall downs of the new era, you know, the sport entertainment.
Sure. Lord Tensai was the other guy you asked about.
Yeah, Lord Tensai, yes.
That's a whole different scenario there. I know that he was a big star in Japan, Giant Bernard, but I'll be honest with you. He had previous stints in WWE as Albert. I never really – he had great size, and he could work for a big man, but I never really saw that it factor in him, and a lot of my colleagues on the writing team sort of felt the same way. I remember when it was announced, Hunter was very excited when they signed it. Hunter came into a booking meeting that we were in with Vince and said, hey, we signed Matt Bloom, you know, Albert, and, you know, he's been in Japan, and he was huge over there, and, you know, he's way better than he used to be, and he's very excited. So we were asked as a writing team to come up with some ideas for Matt Bloom, Albert. And they were all different character types. There was a guy working in Hunter's office who was sort of his right-hand man who was helping him in FCW. It was before we had NXT, Florida Championship Wrestling Developmental, with coming up with characters for the guy. And he had come up with several types. For instance, Albert would be a guy under a mask. He would be a guy in a prison jumpsuit, you know, almost like the old Nails character who would come to jail. I can't even remember some of the other ones, but one of them was like an American samurai. And I remember looking at all, we were presented with all the different character types. And for me, I thought the best thing to do would be to King Mask. And that, you know, so people won't know, you know, the smart fans will know, obviously, but a lot of fans won't know that he was ever Albert, so he won't have that stink on him. And you know, he could really, a good mask guy would really, you know, a mask heel. You haven't had too many of them in a long time.
No, there hasn't been a lot of mask giants.
Instead, I looked at these and I was like, well, the worst thing on here is the samurai. You know, I'm like, I looked at the costumes that they had for him. I looked at they were going to put paint on his face, and I was like, well, as long as we do anything except that, it might be okay. So, of course, Vince was presented with all the different types, and he liked the samurai. So we went with what I personally thought, and a lot of my colleagues thought, was the worst one. And I just think it was just designed, you know, nothing against Matt Bloom personally, but I don't know how anybody really could have succeeded with that gimmick. I just, you know, I thought he looked ridiculous in the getup. And, you know, everyone knew it was Albert, and they were chanting Albert at him. And I just thought the whole thing was destined to fail. And, you know, and Vince, again, it was one of those things, he was really behind at first. Tensai got a huge push. I remember he pinned John Cena on TV, he pinned CM Punk. And then after a while, you know, Vince just fell out of love with it. And that was the end of that. And Tensai ended up becoming a comedy character, teaming with Brodus Clay, of all people.
You know, you mentioned something there about Brodus Clay, you know, like you said, well, it would be against the grain, you know, or against what people would think to be normal to have him be a dancer or, you know, be like, you know, the Brodus Clay character we came to see, you know, but and rather than being the monster that everybody was hoping. But if we look back in WWE's history, we see guys like Dusty Rhodes, Junkyard Dog, Akeem. It seemed like Vince constantly had a penchant to want to put these big guys into a dancing role. And, you know, like you said, can he dance? Is that something that maybe, like, Vince has gone too far with, perhaps? And, you know, maybe that's why these characters are no longer clicking.
I think he's too far with Junkyard Dog alone.
I think Vince absolutely was looking at Brodus as another, you know, Dusty Rhodes or Junkyard Dog or that same kind of character, you know. And I think, you know, maybe that character could work with the right guy. And for whatever reason, Brodus just wasn't the right guy for the gimmick, whether it was the fact that he just didn't fully embrace it or the crowd wasn't ready.
Vince and Pat have very strange senses of humor. Like, I don't think it's the same as the normal wrestling fans' sense of humor, where get these big guys in goofy outfits with polka dots and you know, I don't know if it's punishment or what, but to me I think a lot of people almost were offended by some girl in the little girl in the ring standing about the same, you know, her nose is about the same height as Junkyard Dog's genitals, and he's doing the I don't know, the can-can or something. I don't know what dance he did, but he spread his legs back and forth. You know, and Vince, he's doing it. You know, Vince was like almost orgasmic in his commentating on it.
Well, I can attest to the fact that Vince definitely has one of the strangest sense of humors of anyone I've ever been around, you know, things that he thinks are hilarious, I don't think are funny. And boy, there were things that, you know, me or other members of the writing team thought was really funny, and Vince didn't think it was funny. So,
yeah, I like subtle
truth
humor.
To that.
Yeah.
Well, to move on a little bit from that, you know, you also mentioned that, like, Triple H was very ecstatic about the signing of Matt Bloom. And during your time there, you know, that was when Hunter had kind of taken over the role of talent relations and was starting to actually be the one signing the talent, taking over from John Laurinaitis' failed era. And, some of the names that started coming up while you were there were Sin Cara, a big, huge superstar from Mexico, and Karma. I realize circumstances kind of got in the way of them taking off to where they probably should have been. But, you know, here are some indie darlings, if you will, you know, some of the biggest free agent signings of that time. And, you know, what were plans, you know, well established for these talents to come in and just bad circumstances, or where was it going to be a wait and see kind of attitude?
I mean, there were big plans for both of those stars that you mentioned. I think with Sin Cara, there was some buyer's remorse. Is you know, once he got there, I don't know what it was, but he wasn't the same guy. You know, he, you know, Mystico and you know, huge star in Mexico. He just didn't seem to be the same guy. He was like a fish out of water. I don't know whether it was a culture shock or contrasting styles to the WWE style. I don't know what it was, but it just didn't click. And he was botching moves. And, you know, observing the guy backstage, he was a bit of a loner as well. I don't know if they're, you know, possibly because of the language barrier. But he was a guy that kind of kept to himself and never really seemed to quite fit in, and it just never worked. I mean, they tried, you know, he was given a push. I mean, he had that huge, he had an elaborate entrance, and, you know, he
was the springboard.
He was looking at a guy, he was looked at as a guy who could, you know, kind of be the next Rey Mysterio. But it, obviously he didn't come anywhere close to that. It, you know, I didn't see any evidence that he had anywhere near the charisma of Rey Mysterio. It didn't seem to be as smooth in the ring. So, you know, for whatever reason, he just was not the same guy in WWE that he was in Mexico. Now, Karma, I really think, could have been a big star in the women's division. But, you know, the personal reasons, you know, she got pregnant, ended up losing the baby, and, you know, that was pretty much the end for her. There were some personal issues there, some things they couldn't get past. You know, I think once the pregnancy happened, everything was kind of thrown off, and, you know, it was, I think she was not in a great place mentally after that, understandably, and
yeah.
It was really, they had to cut bait.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of Ronda Singh a little bit, you know, and Ronda did well with Harvey Whippleman, jumping into her arms as opposed to a girl jumping into the man's arms, but their size differences. It was funny, though, when Harvey Whippleman leaped into her arms when she won the title. And as you may recall, Kevin.
Yes, I remember that.
So, you know, like you say, with Karma and Sin Cara, obviously circumstances. Now, do you think that they would have maybe benefited with the current NXT regime? We see guys like Kevin Owens and Finn Balor and Sami Zayn that come into the system, even Shinsuke Nakamura recently, they come into the system, and WWE, and all the fans are saying, oh, they're ready for the main roster, they're ready to main event WrestleMania, but they go to NXT, and invariably, they actually are presented very well down there. Do you think that characters like Sin Cara and Karma might have actually benefited better going through that system first, or do you think it really wouldn't have mattered much?
It's hard to say in hindsight. I think Karma was main roster ready when they signed her. You know, Sin Cara, if they had maybe given him an opportunity to get acclimated down in NXT, it might not have been the worst thing in the world. It might have, you know, get acclimated to a new company, new culture. It may have helped. You know, again, we'll never know now. But certainly, looking back, it probably, you know, wouldn't have been a bad idea.
Are you familiar with my nephew, Theodore? He wrestles as Teddy Hart. I know he had a few chances, opportunities there, and he blew them. But he's still a pretty good little worker and quite a talker.
I'm very familiar with him as far as, you know, I've seen his work. I know his reputation as an in-ring talent. Never met him in person or anything like that, but certainly very aware of how talented he is.
You know, we've all often said of Teddy that, you know, just talent alone, like in-ring and, you know, Michael-wise, probably could have been as big as Bret or even maybe Shawn Michaels or the two combined if he wasn't so heavily involved in negative backstage conflicts, you know, and I think that's always what killed his career.
He is his own worst enemy. He's famous for trying to upstage people where, I know Owen was upstaging Randy Savage a lot, and they said tame it down a bit, Owen, and he was happy to do that. But Ted would just defiantly go out and do it all the more so, you know, upstage your top most established star, and that's pretty stupid. You know, much as I'm his loving uncle and would love to see him flourish in you know, the ultimate, you know, wrestling entity, the WWE, I don't know if it'll ever happen, but... he's worked two shows for me with Heart Legacy Wrestling here, and he was really great, you know, and the fans loved him. And, you know, it's hard to – he was fighting Davey Boy Smith Jr., so, you know, it was hard to love him when he was fighting another guy who was such a good clean-cut babyface. He just put maybe things – I think Ted's still doing well in Mexico after all his you know, chances there. He's back in, I guess, now. So, wish him well.
Anyways, to move forward again here, you know, so we've kind of gone over with Carmen and Sin Cara there. Now, going with that theme, you know, obviously we're seeing the rise during your time in WWE of signing a lot more independent-friendly names, guys like, you know, that have built a name somewhere else outside of the WWE. And, you know, people like CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, they went from being, you know, relative mid-carders during the, you know, before you got there, to while you were there becoming huge, massive superstars, some of the biggest that the company's ever had. And you've seen a philosophical change in the last 5 years from going away from the Rock John Cena prototype, even though guys like Roman Reigns might still get pushed. But in the signing process and the way that the company kind of views talent, we're seeing a lot more of those international names being brought up. Now, is this all Triple H, or is this more of a, you know, a company-wide shift, or where do we attribute all these superstars coming in from?
Well, my impression from when I was there is it is all Triple H, is that he recognizes the talent on the independent scene, and, you know, with what he's trying to do with NXT, which is really, it's a developmental territory, but it's also a separate brand, a separate touring brand. It's WWE's answer to the old ECW or Ring of Honor. You know, that's what they want to make it. That's how it's presented. When you look at guys that get the big push in WWE, again, and now while I was there, you know, Sheamus was a guy that Vince wanted to be the next big guy. That's the guy he got behind. And why? Because he's a big, tall guy. He's muscular. He's got that look of an ass kicker, and that's the kind of guy Vince gets behind. Same thing with Roman Reigns. Guys like CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, it sounds cliche, but it really is. It's the fans that elevated those guys and made them to the point where Vince had no recourse except to push them.
Yeah.
And you could make the case that he really didn't push Daniel Bryan even when he had the fans continued to push him. He got to a certain level.
They did the ante. They wouldn't put. They squelched him, which worked. They shot him down. They tripped him up.
Yep.
I guess that was Hunter doing that and Stephanie. But that seemed to work. That was a decent gimmick over the long haul.
Absolutely. But, you know, even at the height of Daniel Bryan's popularity, Vince never saw him as a long-term top guy. And he had that conversation with us point blank. You know, he said he's not going to be a guy that's going to draw money for us on top over the long haul.
He didn't look like a baby face. He looked like a little, you know, troll or something with a beard. I mean, if they wanted to make him clean cut or sexy or, you know, teenage idol or something, but they kind of just use him as a kind of an amateur wrestling flyer, underdog, martyr, and it got over in itself. But you know, it's hard. You know, fans only got over him because they shit on him so much. You know, and then the you know, creative sense.
Well, Vince referred to him in a production meeting once as a Chief J. Strongbow type. And what he meant by that was, back in the 70s, when Bruno Sammartino was on top as champion, Chief J. Strongbow was the number two babyface for a lot of years. And the heels that came into the territory, they had to get through. Chief J. was the last guy they had to get through to get to Bruno. And he saw Daniel Bryan as a Chief J. Strongbow type. He was not a Bruno. You know, John Cena was Bruno, and Daniel Bryan was Chief J. Strongbow. And that's the analogy that he made. Now, having said that, Vince tried to slot Daniel Bryan into that role, and that was before the big WrestleMania that was built all around Daniel Bryan. You know, Vince just had no choice. The Yes Movement, which is what we called it on TV, and it was a real thing. People just wanted Daniel Bryan. They didn't want Batista and Randy Orton, which was the WrestleMania main event that year. They wanted Daniel Bryan in that slot, and even after Vince called him the Chief J. Strongbow, he had to put him in that spot. But again, Daniel Bryan, even though he won the title at WrestleMania that year, where he beat Randy Orton and Batista in a triple threat match, and earlier in the night beat Triple H. I mean, you talk about putting a guy over, beating Triple H, Orton, and Batista all on the same night. But he was never earmarked for a long title run. And that's just, again, because Vince didn't see him as a long-term top guy. He was a guy, but not the top guy.
You know, I you have to forgive me on this. So this is my analogy of it, is to go back to the 90s and you see a very successful formula. You know, like, I understand Vince is always looking for that next it guy. Hulk Hogan, he's looking for the next one. As soon as Hogan's gone, it's supposed to be the Warrior. But when Warrior doesn't step up, who comes up? And when that scenario happened, it was Bret and Shawn Michaels that really were able to carry that company through the lean years. They built the company back up, became the carpenters that he needed, and laid way so that guys like Steve Austin and The Rock could come in a few years later and dominate, while guys like Mick Foley could be the indie darling that got the pop every once in a while, but Steve Austin and Rock were the trendsetters at that point. And I think that, again, when Steve Austin and The Rock left, you saw Triple H. He was that carpenter guy keeping that company afloat with Eddie Guerrero, until John Cena was ready to take the reins with Batista. Now, John Cena and Batista were gone. It really was, I think, Daniel Bryan and CM Punk that were the next carpenters to build up to the next era. But when that fell through, that's where we're left right now without anybody to kind of carry the ship at this point, I think. I don't know if you – does that make sense or
– Yeah, yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. And, you know, Vince – like, it's obvious. I mean, you look at the guys he gets behind. Sheamus was a guy. Roman Reigns, you know, was the next guy he was really excited about. As much as, you know, I think he appreciates what guys like Bret and Shawn brought to the table, and CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, you know, brought, he's always going to look at a guy with a certain – he's looking for a certain it factor, and a part of that it factor with Vince is the look. And he uses the word visceral a lot, you know, from a visceral standpoint. You know, he wants a guy who walks into a room and has a commanding presence. He looks like he's somebody. He looks like he could win a fight. And I understand what he's saying, but I also think that, you know, times have changed. And I think people will accept that a guy doesn't necessarily have to look like the baddest dude walking on the planet to you know, it's still believable that a guy like Daniel Bryan could beat anybody, you know, regardless of their size. At least, I mean, that's the way I
think
feel. A guy like
I've over the years have formed the opinion that you know, you have to look like a fighter. You know, it's sports entertainment secondary, but it's combatants, it's fighting, it's competition, it's you know, contest between two guys, big or small. Usually, to me, there should be black and white difference. Like, this guy's a villain, he's bad. And this guy's a good guy, he's popular, he's clean. And, you know, and then the entertainment should come in after, you know, seconds of the fact.
And going with what Smith just said there, you take like a character like Brock Lesnar, who exemplifies almost every single thing that, you know, you would think to be a top star.
Or Kozlov.
But he still is a monster, right? So, you know, to transition to that, Brock Lesnar came back while you were there, right?
Yes, he did.
And the first match back, you know, you would think, get him on a roll, get him winning and everything like that. And, you know, in the first year, in the first, like, what, 3-4 matches, he went, you know, 2-for-2, right? In that first year back.
Yeah.
Was that a Vince decision in terms of, like, sitting there saying, okay, well, you know, we're not going to let him go off on a and beat our guys
beat Cena. Yeah, he can't beat Cena.
Yeah, well, if you remember, the Brock came back the night after Rock and John Cena had wrestled each other at WrestleMania, where Rock had beaten Cena. So the main mission there was, yes, we wanted to get a big surprise and a big pop when Brock showed up, and Brock versus Cena was going to be, you know, hopefully a big box office draw on the pay-per-view. But they were really trying to – Vince was very mindful of, you know, Cena is still our top guy, and he's there.
Really?
He is our guy that's there every night, every week. Brock's going to be a part-time player. And Brock was seen as a guy who could help to rebuild Cena after his big loss to Rock. So that's why Brock lost that first match to Cena. It was all about rebuilding John, who's going to be the guy who's still doing all the house shows. He's the main guy on Raw every week, and Brock was going to be a guy who comes and goes. Now the way that match was structured, I didn't hate it, I'll be honest with you, because Brock dominated that match. It was unlike anything else that you'd ever seen in WWE at that point. It looked like a UFC fight.
It was a phenomenal match. I can't take that away from either guy.
Right. It looked like a fight, and Brock, you know, I think if you were scoring on points, as they say, you know, Brock dominated that match. Brock beat the hell out of him. And, you know, Cena, the never-give-up guy, he found a way to win at the end. But I think you would say, well, if you watch that match, I think you would come away from it saying, you know, Cena got the win, but Brock won the war, you know, kind of thing. So that was what that was all about. What I didn't like, and this happened while I was there, is I really wasn't a big fan of the series of matches between Triple H and Brock. I didn't mind Cena beating Brock, but I don't think Triple H should have beaten Brock. I thought that was a mistake.
I agree 100%. Another match that happened at WrestleMania 29 that I wanted to ask you about, and again, you know, going back to that night, I'm sure you were there for WrestleMania 29 in New York.
Yep.
And that was the night that Fandango debuted against Chris Jericho, one of Stampede's alumni. And, you know, looking, you know, I don't know, maybe going into it, you might see some validation to say, well, here we got this, you know, part-time himself. We want to put Fandango over strong. I want to make him a future it guy, but in retrospect, was that really the, like, again, I don't know if this is a Vince decision or a company-wide decision, but how did that all kind of come about?
It was totally a Vince decision, and I can tell you, as I said earlier, Vince falls in love with certain characters, and sometimes
dancers.
He falls out of love.
Mm-hmm.
Yep,
Men
there
dancing.
You go, back to the dancing thing. Vince fell in love with the Fandango character. He was very hands-on with it. He was the one that told Fandango how to speak, you know, to draw out the Fandango. I remember watching Vince go over it with him and enunciate how to do it, making him repeat it over and over. Vince was very, very hands-on with that character and had big, high expectations for him. I could say myself, you know, and I think some other members of the writing team, we thought, we all liked Johnny Curtis. We thought he was a good hand, and you know, we thought he could do something with that character. But I don't think we ever saw the potential in it that Vince did. So as WrestleMania time was rolling around and we knew we had Chris, I can't remember now. It's been several years. But we were throwing around various opponents for him. I think Wade Barrett was one. We've thrown a couple other names out there. I can't remember. But Vince finally, in a meeting one day, just said, it's going to be Fandango. And we all thought he was joking. And he said, nope, it's going to be Fandango, and Chris is going to do the honors. Chris is going to put him over at WrestleMania. And I think we all just kind of looked at each other like, is this a rib, or, you know, is he serious? And we quickly found out he was serious. And I think part of it was Vince wanted to rib Jericho. I really do. Jericho obviously did not want to do it. When Jericho was informed that he was facing Fandango on the biggest stage and putting him over, Jericho's a pro, and he went out and did it to the best of his ability, but he certainly wasn't happy about it. And he thought it was a misuse of him. And I think, to a man, we all agreed with him on the writing team. I think it was nothing against, you know, Fandango, Johnny Curtis, good guy, talented, but that really wasn't – that was pretty much a travesty, I thought, Jericho putting him over at WrestleMania. And I tell you this, every time Jericho's come back since then, he has basically – I won't say he has creative control, but he won't come back unless he's told ahead of time, here are the plans for you, here are the guys you're going to be working with. And we had a term for it. We would say Chris doesn't want to get Fandangoed again, and he won't allow himself to get Fandangoed. So that's why you see Jericho early now. He's working against AJ Styles. He's working against Sami Zayn, Dean Ambrose. He's not going to do the Fandango thing ever again.
Absolutely. So I don't mean to put you on the spot then. So just to ask you a pretty blunt question, in your opinion from being there, is Vince perhaps out of touch with today's viewer?
I think he is to some extent, you know. He's a 70-year-old man, and he kind of lives in that bubble of WWE. Now, he surrounds himself with people who are knowledgeable about pop culture and things like that, but I think he is out of touch in some ways. I think he kind of has certain preconceived notions in his head.
I would never take anything away from Vince's business acumen in terms of actual business. He's built a billion-dollar empire. He's been able to keep wrestling alive when every other company, you know, fails. And he is always on top of the next business decision, the next media wave. Nothing taking away from his business strategies. I feel personally like, you know, especially when, you know, we hear you talk and, you know, everything seems to come back to always Vince makes this decision. He falls in love. He falls out of love. Maybe he's not creatively inclined to the way he once was. And to go a little further, do you think the company will be in better hands with either Triple H and Stephanie, or if maybe Shane comes back into the picture when the company succeeds the next generation?
Well, it's interesting you ask that because
I don't think so myself.
What's that?
You weren't asking me, Matt, but I don't think so.
Okay, well, let's ask Kevin here. Sorry.
Okay.
Well, you know, that's something we talked about amongst ourselves at times, you know, the writing team I'm talking about, is, you know, what's it going to be like when Hunter takes over? Will it be better? And our thinking was, again, I don't know from a business standpoint. To your point, Vince, is obviously he's built this empire. You can't fault him for that. You can't knock him for that. I don't know about Triple H's business acumen, but from a creative standpoint, I do feel like Hunter, being younger, having been one of the boys for so many years, I do think he has a more modern sense of what the current fan wants, more so than Vince does. So, you know, if you just look at what Hunter's done with NXT and the guys that have come through NXT up to the main roster, you know, I do think company will – and look, who knows when this is ever going to happen. I don't think Vince is going to give up the ship, you know, very easily. He could be in charge another 20 years. Who knows?
Right.
But, yeah, to wrap that up, I do think – my feeling is it will get better under Hunter from a creative standpoint.
It's kind of too bad that Rusev couldn't dance, you know, because they didn't do much with him. At least he's wearing shoes now, but he could have used some extra height, you know. He's pretty squat, and, you know, it was a good gimmick with the girl and all that, and they played up on, what's the Russian guy, the leader, the prime minister of Russia?
Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, they still flogged that in the big gaudy star medal that he got, but, you know, to me, you know, he didn't look Russian at all. He just looked like a big, squat, hairy bodybuilder, power lifter, and, you know, at least the other Russian, Kozlov, he danced a little bit, didn't he, with Santino? He went through some little sick performance routine entertainment. amusement.
Yeah, what happens
whatever
a lot of times with these monster heels, after they have their run or don't necessarily get over, then they become these dancing guys. You know, it's what they did with Great Khali.
Oh, that's so foolish. Like, yep. Abdul the Butcher was just nothing but a monster the whole time, day in, day out. You know, he never changes. He's just a crazy, wild Arab. And
right.
He made more money in his era than anybody around that I know of. And,
I was going to say, can you imagine Vince going to Undertaker and asking him to start dancing now?
I don't think you're going to
see
that
one. Vince wanting that, doing the ghost dance or something.
Well, we have taken up quite a bit of your time here, Kevin, and we've really appreciated the conversation here tonight. You've really given us a pretty good insight. I just got a couple more questions here. What led to you leaving the WWE, and will you ever be seen going back, or are you now done with that chapter of your career?
I believe it's done. It wasn't my decision to leave. There were budget cuts that took place in the summer of 2014. It was, the stock took a big hit, and we got the word that there were going to be budget cuts across all departments. And I had a feeling, I knew they were going to make some cuts on the writing team. I had a feeling because of the salary that I was making at that point. I was older than a lot of the guys on the team and was therefore making a little bit more money. And, I thought that I could very well be on the chopping block. Also, because I was mainly a home team guy and wasn't on the road, I know that Vince didn't value the guys that didn't go on the road as much as those who did. So I had a couple things I thought were working against me, and so it really didn't blindside me. So that's why I'm not with the company anymore. And as far as going back, I really don't have any desire to do it. You know, it was a dream job in a sense, and I got to do it for 3 years, had a great time doing it. But there's a lot of headaches that go with working that closely with Vince McMahon. As much as it's rewarding at times, it's also very frustrating, and there are a lot of headaches to go with it too. So I don't necessarily miss it.
Roger Murray could have kept you employed, I think.
What's that?
I said I think Arthur Murray might have given you a little more longevity.
Yeah, that's right.
Going with that, and then like you're still involved with a few of the local independents in the Baltimore area. I know you manage a stable called the Ectorage.
Good name.
Do you have any kind of aspirations to work in creative for anybody else? Lucha Underground, Ring of Honor, or any other global force? Have you had any kind of preliminary conversations with anybody else?
What's the old never say never in wrestling? I certainly wouldn't rule anything out, if an opportunity came along. Right now I am just, I'm having fun working with Maryland Championship Wrestling, being a heel manager, being a performer, something that I always wanted to do, and I've gotten to do that. Maryland Championship Wrestling is one of the better independents out there. It's very professionally run, so that's a blast. As far as working for another company in the future, I don't know. If somebody makes me an offer and it sounds good, then I would love to get back involved again. But I don't see ever going back to work for WWE. Definitely don't want to live in Connecticut anymore. I've since moved out. Cost of living there is a little crazy. So, who knows? Who knows what? I'm still blogging about wrestling. I have a blog that I do. And you mentioned doing the independent thing. So I still got my hand in it to some extent.
Wanted to say, Kevin, that I thought the Bray Wyatt was really coming on strong as a different, sinister kind of heel, another oddball, crazy guy like the Wayland Mercy type, or an evil hillbilly, and they just lost it all. They split them up, and they cut them off at the pass. They're coming back now, but it seemed like they killed it. Months ago.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound like a broken record or make this a everything I say. I don't want it to sound like I'm bashing Vince, but I don't think Vince ever really got what the Wyatt family was all about. I don't think he really ever understood the characters. The Wyatt family was created in NXT under Hunter's watch. A lot of that came from Bray Wyatt himself. A lot of what you see of that character is stuff he came up with. And when they were brought up to the main roster, I think Vince, he recognized that there was something about these guys that's different and unique and interesting, but I don't think he ever really understood what they were, which obviously they were. It's a playoff of the Manson family, and he's a cult leader. And I don't think Vince really got that. He thought they were more supernatural-type characters, and that's why we had some, you know, he tried to make them almost like an Undertaker and Kane, when I don't really think that's what they were more – they were supposed to be more realistic.
They were better than that. Yeah, they were more believable.
Absolutely. They were more believable. At one point, I remember we were in a meeting with Vince, and we were pitching – for someone to join the Wyatt family. I can't remember who it was, but we said, you know, Bray is trying to add more followers. And Vince, with a very straight face, looked at us and said, why would Bray want followers? And that pretty much shut that conversation down, because it was just clear he did not understand the cult leader. And he was all about followers. So.
Yeah, I was, you know, just waiting for the Shield to fight them, you know, 3-on-3-on-3 and all that. And this number, you know, they split everybody up.
Well, they had a series of matches. They did, you know, work a few times, and it was magical whenever they got together. I mean, Shield and the Wyatts was always a crowd-pleasing match. But, yeah, I think Bray Wyatt, you know, he's a very talented guy. But, man, I'm worried about where they're at this point. I know he just got injured again, but I don't know. It looks like they might be doing a little babyface turn with him, which I think could work if he becomes sort of a Jake the Snake Roberts-type sinister babyface. But whatever it is, I think he needs a change, because the Wyatt family, unfortunately, has gotten some stink on him just because they haven't been booked very well.
Yeah, they've lost three consecutive WrestleManias in a row, you know, and he's always come out on the shit end of the stick, you know, John Cena, Undertaker.
I thought that was premature for him to fight Brock when he did. I didn't get that.
But, so just to move it along a little further, though. All right, so in the 3 years that you were with the company, 3.5 years you were with the company, what would you say is the best thing that you contributed yourself to that you were very proud of, that you wanted to stand out as your legacy, if anything?
Well, I'll definitely there are two things, really. One is I pitched the Mark Henry faux retirement deal, where he came, if you remember that, he came out in like a salmon colored suit and was announcing his retirement, and it was just a swerve to attack John Cena. And the way that came about was, we needed a one-off for Cena. He was between programs, and Vince needed a one-off. And we said, Mark Henry's going to, you know, we looked at the roster. Okay, we'll make it Mark Henry. And then Vince said, well, what's the story? Give me a story. And I came up with that whole retirement thing, because it's something that Mark had once, I know Mark was pitching it at one point to make a big deal out of his retirement. And so I thought, why? But I think he wanted it to be more of a babyface thing. I said, why don't we do it with the swerve? You know, Mark comes out, says he's going to retire, and then attacks John Cena, and it leads to the, you know, that's the match, the pay-per-view. So that was my idea. The other thing that I'm really proud of is, I feel like, I'm not going to take any credit, okay, for Daniel Bryan's incredible success, but I feel like I had a small part in lighting the spark. Because when I got to WWE, Daniel Bryan was the Money in the Bank holder, but he couldn't even get on TV. I don't know if you remember back then, but if he was on TV, he was probably doing a job for somebody. Otherwise, he was working superstars. They were doing nothing with him. I looked at him, and then I looked at AJ Lee. And she had just come on the main roster. She had been at NXT. And I just looked at two of them, and I thought they could be another Spike Dudley and Molly Holly, if you remember this little romance they had. Or even on a different level, sort of a Macho Man and Elizabeth. So it was my idea to put Daniel with AJ and ultimately have Daniel turn heel and possibly be a world title contender. That was I made that pitch. And that's one of the things we started, was we put Daniel and AJ together. It still didn't help him initially. He was still the guy walking around with a briefcase and not really doing much. But a series of events happened Mark Henry got injured. He was the world champion at the time. Daniel had that Money in the Bank briefcase. And next thing you know, he cashes in. He becomes the champion. And then Vince was like, all right, what are we going to do with this guy now that he's got the title? And it was Vince's idea to make him a heel, a guy where success went to his head. And I said, well, why don't we use AJ? Like, AJ's already sort of his girlfriend. Why don't we use AJ to help get him over as a heel, where he berates her, belittles her, and that's what they went with. And, you know, from that, Daniel obviously exploded, and AJ was probably the most over diva, I mean, they won't call them divas anymore, you know,
that's right,
in some time. So I will take credit for being the one to put those two together. And a little funny story with that is I pitched it to the both of them at TV one day, one of the times I was on the road. And, again, they weren't doing much, neither one of them. And I figured Daniel, when I told him, I thought he would be ecstatic, right? So I pitched the idea, and AJ immediately says, oh, I love it. This is great. It's going to be great to work with Daniel. And Daniel said, yeah, you know, very respectfully, because he's a very respectful guy. But he's like, you know, you got to be honest. And he's like, and his reason was they had done a storyline with him once before with the Bellas and Gail Kim. And he's like, they put me with, you know, Gail Kim. And he's like, it wasn't what I was told it was going to be, and it was bad. And he's like, I'm just not sure I want to get involved with a diva again. And I was like, okay. When I was, it was a little disappointing for me to hear that he wasn't into it. So I remember going back to Brian Gewirtz, who was running the home team, and I said, yeah, AJ's very down with the idea, but Daniel didn't like it. And Gewirtz was basically like, well, tough, you know, tough. Daniel's going to have to like it because this is what we're doing. And Daniel should be happy that we're coming up with something for him. So
it all worked out in the end. Well, and likewise,
all worked out
that,
in the end.
Is there any angle that you pitched that you didn't go through that you thought would have been a huge money angle? Any kind of thing you wish could have gone through that really could have been big money?
I don't know about big money. I mean, I can remember a lot of, you know, we all had a lot of angles that were shot down over the years. One of the things I wanted to do with Roman Reigns was acknowledge his Samoan heritage.
Absolutely.
We were doing a program with The Shield, which it was Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins. Dean was the U.S. champion, so he was involved in singles programs. Roman and Seth were the tag team. And they were doing a program with the Usos. Now, as everybody knows, or a lot of people know, Reigns and the Usos, not only are they cousins, but they really grew up together and were very close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I said, why don't we do that? You know, why don't we come out in the storyline? And I wanted to get Rikishi involved, the Usos' father, and I wanted to have the Shield attack Rikishi. And that's when it all comes out that Roman is the bad seed of the family. You know, he went bad, joined the Shield. He was estranged. And then go back and tell their story. And the Usos, again, the Usos and Roman were very much into the idea. I pitched it to them. They both liked it. And they said they had all kind of pictures of them growing up together. Well, you know, they played sports together. So we could put video packages together of, you know, showing these old pictures and the whole thing. And I was really, really excited about it because it wouldn't just be a tag team title program anymore between two teams. Now there's a huge personal issue. Over, because it's family, attacking family.
Yeah, it's
so
putting a whole new
it.
Dimension into the entertainment part of it. It's making it a shoot almost, like his family
exactly,
is legit.
Exactly. I presented it, and I was thinking that, you know, Vince and Hunter are going to love it. And both of them had the same reaction, which was, we don't want to admit that Roman is Samoan because it's going to pigeonhole him. And we're not going to acknowledge that.
You
which
know,
I thought was crazy because being Samoan never
didn't hurt the rock.
Didn't hurt the rock any. And I was just like, wow, this just seems like a blown opportunity. And but they were very adamant that they didn't want to reveal that Roman was related to the Usos, that he was like they just didn't want to even say he was Samoan.
Mm-hmm.
Which is funny to me because after I left the company a couple years later. It's all that's the big thing now is talking about Roman Samoan heritage and how he's close with the Usos and his father was Sika of the Wild Samoan. So now it's okay to do it. Probably the angle I really wish we would have that I pitched that I wish would have gone through. But I pitched so many different things for guys like Drew McIntyre. I was a big fan of his. Jack Swagger, just guys that I thought we're very talented, but we're just being ignored. And I'll tell you, another one was TJ, Tyson Kidd. I looked at I was trying to help the tag team division at one point. We had Primo and Epico, the clones, were tag team champions.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
And they were, even though they were champions, they were being buried. They were tag team champions who lost all the time. And I was really trying to, like, put some new teams together. And I looked and I saw there's TJ and there's Justin Gabriel, and neither one of them are doing anything. They're just guys that show up to TV. They just sit back in the locker room. They're not even getting to work. Why don't we put those two together as a team and give them a push? And I got so far as getting them together as a team, but no push. No matter how hard I tried, it's just, for whatever reason, Vince just didn't see much in those guys as far as tag. I think he thought they were bland and didn't have a lot of personality. But obviously, you know TJ, the guy has a lot of personality, and he just never given an opportunity to show it. So he had the reputation of being a prankster backstage, a river. I pitched, why don't we make that the gimmick of, okay, we all know Justin Gabriel and Tyson Kidd could put together an exciting match. I thought that almost worked against them in the sense that Vince saw them as guys who were good hands, but no personality. So I thought, all right, what could give them personality? Let's make them the pranksters.
That would have worked.
And to try and get Vince to accept it, I said, why don't we put Hornswoggle with them? This is the only way I thought it would get through. What if we put Hornswoggle as part of their act, and the three of them are like these fun-loving guys? Tyson and Justin will kill it in the ring, but they're also these pranksters backstage. They play ribs on the heels and the whole thing. So I presented that whole storyline to Vince, that whole character thing. And we even shot some stuff. We shot some backstage vignettes just on our own. I would just get Tyson and Justin and Hornswoggle together with one of our camera guys and just shoot some stuff, them playing pranks on guys, and then show it to Vince. And Vince said, you know what? That's a good idea. I love the idea of Hornswoggle being the prankster. But you know what? I don't like Tyson and Justin in that role. I'm going to give it to the great Kali. Kali and Hornswoggle are going to be the pranksters. And that's, for a very short time, that's what they did, is Kali and Hornswoggle were together. I think they even threw Natty in there at one point with them.
Yep.
With the whole
farting gimmick.
With the whole fart. Oh, my God, don't even get me started on that. I was so opposed to that. But I remember I'm the one who had to tell TJ, you know, after the meeting. I said, I got good news and bad news. I'm like, good news is Vince loves the gimmick. Bad news is he's giving it to Kali instead of you and Justin. And
someday, maybe we'll see Vince dance.
So, all right, well, yeah, definitely that would have been – yeah, I like what Court Bauer said about Roman Reigns. I don't know if you know Court Bauer very well or not, but I listen to his podcast every once in a while, and he always says that if you actually look at it, Roman Reigns is only 2 to 3 generations away from Bones in the Noses cannibals, really. And, like, that's a heritage that is legit and real and something that that family, next to my co-host here, one of the greatest families in all of professional wrestling, is certainly something that should be acknowledged, and I definitely agree with you. We've given, obviously, the best to now. Is there any angle that you got through that, for whatever reason, that you pitched, you pushed through, and it got through, and it ended up turning into be the drizzling shits or something that went wrong? Is there something that, maybe – if you don't want to mention anything, I understand, but
the first thing that comes to mind is it was a mid-card comedy thing, admittedly, but we had Emma from NXT coming up to the main roster, and she, she plays this real quirky, kind of silly character, and she had done a little bit of work in NXT with Santino, so it seemed like they had good chemistry, so I was the one who came up with the idea of the two of them being a couple, but the story was going to be that she was oblivious, that he was so into her, but she never picked up on the attraction. She thought they were buddies. She thought they were friends. And that was going to be the ongoing thing, is she constantly looked at him like a friend, and he was in love with her, but he always stumbled when he tried to tell her, and she never really understood it. Zack Ryder at this time had already been buried and wasn't doing anything. My idea was to insert him as the guy who would sort of help Santino, try to teach him how to get over with the ladies. And long story short, he was going to end up stealing Emma from Santino, and Zach was going to be a heel. That was where it was going to go. And we started down that path, and we did some vignettes with Emma and Santino, and I think it was one of those things where Vince just didn't really get Emma, or didn't like the two of them together.
It was too subtle.
Just,
I think it was too. It spelled success. They're afraid of success sometimes. They don't want anything to eclipse the show itself.
Yeah,
that was really good. I almost burst out saying you should have turned Ryder heel, and you know that was your next word. You're not thinking along the same lines as far as that goes.
So, definitely. I think that was just something that could have gotten through. I think with different set of circumstances, but
I don't think you should ever overlook the natural. Like that was a natural thing. It was the characters all fit the role, and there was nothing else going on that would have precluded them being involved. You know, it's something you could slip in without taking away from anything else that's already on the boil. You know.
Well, the funny part of all that is that now in real life, Zach and Emma are dating. I don't know if you knew that, but they're actually a couple.
Emma had
a
very nice
in real life,
buttocks.
Which was funny because at the time back then they didn't even know each other.
Yeah. Well, the last question I really have for you is that I think a lot of fans today, you see the business has been widely exposed, and a lot of fans judge the business more and rather than on the getting into it and actually wanting to see people beat their the foes and everything like that and get totally immersed in the product. Everybody seems to look at it from a booking point of view, and they're always looking for the best booking decisions and such. I think a lot of people underestimate the true talent of people like yourselves and the politics that you have to deal with when you're actually in that system. Would you recommend the creative process to aspiring, wannabe bookers, or would you say it's maybe not all it's cracked up to be?
As far as being on the WWE creative team?
Yeah, on the WWE creative team.
That's a difficult question. I'll say this. No matter how many writers we had, like I said, I think at one point we had 26, we had a saying that at the end of the day, the show has one writer, okay, and that obviously that one writer is Vince, and that's good and bad in a sense. Is that you need a decider, you need someone to finally make that decision when you have all people pitching all different kinds of ideas. But the problem with it was, I think sometimes he didn't always make the best decision, or the decision that the majority of us were in favor of. It's a frustrating job in the sense that a lot of ideas that you think are good and that you're passionate about and that you pitch that get shot down for what seem like silly reasons, such as we can't say Roman Reigns is Samoan because it's going to hurt him. That's very frustrating to deal with. But it's also very gratifying when you get an angle like the Mark Henry retirement on TV, something that people really it resonated and people talked about. Knowing that was my idea is very rewarding. So it has its ups and downs, that's for sure. Dealing with Vince is, it's crazy. It's like, I think the best people, the happiest people in WWE were the people who, maybe saw Vince in an elevator once a month or something. That was their only interaction with him. Because dealing with him on a weekly basis, especially being with him at TV, it's a challenge, that's for sure.
Nice way of putting it.
Well, Kevin, I want to thank you very much for being so forthright and giving with all your information here tonight. You've been a wonderful guest, best guest we've had so far, and we really want to thank you very much for your time. If people are looking to get a hold of you, like, I don't know if you, you're very public or if you just, is there ways that fans can reach out to you maybe?
Well, sure. I have a blog called The X Factor, which it's kevineckwrestling.sportsblog.com. And Eck is ECK. So Kevin Eck Wrestling, or you could just Google The X Factor Wrestling blog and it'll come up.
Kevin, just before we sign off and all that, I do want to wish you well with your promotion in Baltimore. I'd love to exchange talent with you. I was just wondering if you ever had any interaction with Billy Corgan. He's now a writer for TNA, and he's a pretty nice guy, and I think he's got a lot of good ideas. I gather that a lot of them aren't surfacing. They got the same kind of obstacles, you might say, with the hierarchy there, where something, if it's not their idea, they don't want to entertain it. But did you ever meet Billy or talk to him? He does go to a lot of wrestling events.
Yeah, I know people who know Billy, but I've never actually crossed paths with him myself. But I know how big of a fan he is. I know I've always heard that he has a good mind for the business.
Yeah, he's a hell of a guy. He's been very good to my family as far as, attending his concerts and things. And I think he's a pretty clean living individual. I wish him well too. So anyway, Kevin, I enjoyed the interview, and I wish you all the luck in your promotion.
I appreciate it. It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Kevin. You have a wonderful day, and we'll keep in touch down the road.
All right, sounds good.
Thank you, Matt, too. You asked some great questions.
Well, thank you, Smith. It's another great interview. You've been a great
Who we got next week? We got somebody pretty good.
Next week we have the former owner of Ring of Honor, Kerry Silken, will be joining us. It's another chance to get inside another creative mind, learn the insides of the Ring of Honor business and the such that went down with the transfer of ownership from, Kerry Silken to Sinclair Broadcasting. It's going to be a great interview, I'm sure. So please tune in next week to hear us talk about Kerry Silken. And also I want to let everybody know we got a brand new sponsor on board. So Smith Hart and the Hart family are going to be setting up a shop on ProWrestlingTees.com. Go to ProWrestlingTees.com, get your shirts, get your Smith Hart shirts, and anything else associated with the Hart family.
Yeah, I'm busy designing them right now, certain ones.
Do you have anything coming up this week, Smith, that you want to let people know about?
Well, I'm doing some work with the Tutina Nation. The SRC Indian Reserve is being very generous, and we're talking big things in the future. They got some great facilities out there and a big casino, and they've all been tremendous supporters of wrestling over the years, and with the Ranchmans kind of spearheading it with some rodeo and all that, I'm looking to for good things to happen soon. Maybe Stampede Week will have a big turnout, and we're working on a big card for that, July 10th.
Excellent. Well, so long from the Sunshine State, everybody. We've had a great show. You can find Smith Hart at SmithHart1 on Twitter. My Twitter is MattGarrett1, and we want to wish everybody a very happy week, and we'll see you next week with Kerry Silken.
Yeah, right here in the Sunshine Province, Alberta.
Excellent.
Adios.
Adios.
Okay.
Attention sports fans, collectors, hobbyists, and autograph seekers. Are you looking for the best in sports cards and collectibles? The only name you need to know is Carl's. That's right, Carl's Cards and Collectibles in Havertown, PA not only has the best collection of sports memorabilia, cards, game, used merchandise, and autograph signings of top professional athletes, he also does custom framing too. Go to carlscards.com or like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Carl's Cards. That's Carl's Cards and Collectibles, 22 West Eagle Road in Havertown, PA. Remember, Carl's, the only and best name in sports cards and collectibles. For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Trash City Beads, the great bead store with the weird name. Selling beads and findings for over 25 years. Visit us online at TrashCity.com. Like us on Facebook at Trash City Beads. Unique beads, charms, crystals, and findings from all over the world at wholesale prices. No store, no showroom. We are online only. Visit us at TrashCity.com. Trash City Beads is your online source for the best beads on the planet. Remember the name, Trash City Beads.
Hey everybody, this is Nick Wilkinson from TV Nation and Totally Driven Radio and Entertainment. Sadly, each year, approximately 3.6 million children become victims of child abuse. My latest ebook, Child Abuse, The Ripple Effect, explores the long-lasting effects abuse can have on victims. Explore life after the abuse ends and how we cope with the tragedies of the past. Child Abuse, The Ripple Effect is available on Kindle for only 99 cents. And don't forget to check out my website, actingnotreacting.com, a common sense approach to teens in crisis. Let's work together and make this world a better place. And remember, stay driven.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromHolmes.
Are you ready to be totally driven? Totally Driven Entertainment Network has a full lineup of shows dedicated to total entertainment. Starting on Mondays, we have the always relevant and often hilarious Hard Talk with Big Daddy and Big Booty Trudy. That's at 6 p.m. And at 11 p.m., go 8 flights up and get your mind right. Tuesdays at noon, Pro Wrestling Now with Mike Ferreira covers professional wrestling news, rumors, and one-of-a-kind interviews with professional wrestling performers and insiders. At 8 p.m., join Smith Hart of the legendary Hart Family Dynasty for the Hart Grapevine as he goes behind the scenes and shares his knowledge of the professional wrestling industry and some truly remarkable special interviews, too. Welcome to Hump Day, Wednesdays, 9:30 a.m., the Coco and Wee Wee Show asks the age-old question, who do you love, who do you shove? And at 8 p.m., the Give No F's Cosplay Variety Hour brings you the best in cosplay, comics, video games, and more. Thursday nights at 5 p.m., Pro Wrestling Now with Mike Ferreira returns to the airwaves to cover professional wrestling news, results, and more. At 8 p.m., Totally Driven Radio, the show that started it all, brings you the best in topical conversations, celebrity interviews, exclusive musical guests, and so much more. Your Friday night would be incomplete without a trip to Uncle Shawnee's Playground. Join Uncle Shawnee at 8 p.m. and prepare to be offended, but, you know, in a good way. At 10 p.m., don't forget the LAW Retro Wrestling Hour, bringing back the golden age of professional wrestling. Saturday mornings at 10 a.m., the Mojo Sports Show starts your weekend off with a healthy dose of sports mojo. Get the latest news, scores, results, and more every Saturday morning. At 9 p.m., Totally Driven Radio rocks. Bay Ragney unleashes his inner beast as he takes you on a heavy metal journey and looks at the music he thinks rocks. That brings us to Sunday morning, the perfect time for a big weenie. At 10 a.m., the Big Weenie Castanini Show goes live around the world. And ending the week at 9 p.m. on Sunday nights, join the TV Nation for your weekly dose of the Nerd Herd and talk all things comics, TV, movies, and pop culture. Remember, get driven, stay driven.